Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Vote Plan Podcast. I am your host, Marquise Olison. On this podcast, where we talk about voting, elections, technology, the future, theater, arts, entertainment, and how all this relates to that every couple of years thing that we do where we remake our democracy, voting and elections. Today on the show, I have the amazing Miles Stroth. Miles is the owner of the Pack Theater. He goes back to the beginnings of improv with Mr. Del Close being in one of the founding troops and one of the most inspirational and one of the most impactful troops of improv, The Family, back in Chicago. Miles is a teacher. He's amazing. He's a performer. He's an artist with words. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, please give a round of applause for Mr. Miles Stroth.
Well, thank you very much, Marquise. That was very kind.
Now, for one of the things, you teach improv. And for the folks that are listening to this that are like, what is improv? I should probably start with that. What is improv for the folks at home hearing about this for the first time?
Improv is, well, that's a big, broad question. What is improv? It's an art form. It comes out of the idea of just there's no script. You're going to make it up on the spot. The major tenets of it that are important are paying attention to the other person on stage, listening to the other person on stage. It's not something you're doing by yourself. You're generally doing it with at least one other person, sometimes many more than one other person. And on the fly, you're creating art. Mm-hmm. It's like Tai Chi in a way. It's, meditative, it's introspective, it's exploratory. It gives you the opportunity to comment on reality, to explore it. It's a wonderful art form. It comes out of theater, mm-hmm. Basically. Again, there's a lot of ways you could answer the question, what is improv? Mm-hmm. To me, it's a means to explore the world and express myself, and to hopefully, bring some kind of happiness to those who perceive it.
Mm-hmm. I think it's for a lot of people there, what they see improv is essentially whose line is it anyway, or the people who may have now seen the new, where I think they did 227 and a couple, like Norman Lear did an improv television show where they had folks go and they improvise the lines with an outline, or maybe Curb Your Enthusiasm, where they work from an outline. On stage, a lot of times you start with nothing and build a whole world together. How does that process kind of work for somebody that's just stepping into that?
Well, for someone that's just stepping in, the idea is that you're going to start, there are different ways a show can start. Say you have a simple suggestion. Based on that suggestion, you're going to start something. Someone's going to start something, and the other person's going to listen and react to that, and the process has begun. As it continues, you'll slowly create a scene, and then a second scene, and in those scenes, there become connections, and those connections turn into whatever form the show is going to take that night. There are known forms that you can play or follow, or you can just sort of make it up as you go. The primary thing for someone just stepping in is that you get to basically, and it's funny because if you're just stepping in, you're probably already better off, because someone who's just starting, they're going to do something that's very useful, which is they're going to listen and say the first thing that occurs to them. Whereas once people start trying too hard, they start ignoring their own basic reaction, they start trying to over-invent. I think one of the primary tenets at our theater is that you're already enough. Anyone can do it. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, you're already enough to be able to do it. So just listen and, react with how you perceive the world. Mm-hmm. that's where it all begins. With, you know, we try to find a way to agree and move forward with another human being.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the great things for me was before I got into politics, I studied improv, and it was one of my secret weapons. Like I led some what are called Camp Obama trainings, where you teach people how to organize. And one of the modules is teaching them story of self, and you teach them how to work together. You teach them about teamwork and all these other things. Well, most other trainers needed to go read the book, memorize the book, memorize what they would say before they talked to an audience. And then they were afraid because they were like, I don't know if I'm going to say it. I'm like, dude, I've been doing improv for like 5 years. Once I knew the material really quickly, I could just stand up in front of people and just be like, all right, let's do a whole 2-day seminar. So all I'm doing is improvising off of this material. I even had a trick where somebody had me introduce Senator Barbara Boxer, like out of the blue. She showed up to this campaign office election night 2016, and something happened and she couldn't come in right away. So I basically did one-man improv for like 12 minutes, entertaining the crowd before introducing a senator on her, essentially her last night being a senator. And I only have been able to do that because of the artwork and the art form that you have taught to give people the confidence to be able to trust their own voice, trust their own mind, and to have a rubric for which that they could speak to and to draw a crowd in so that they can hear and understand.
Yeah, I think most people have that in them. It's like in that moment, which sounds like a hell of a moment to be stuck in, you have to trust yourself and not like, I'm sure you were wonderful, because I know you would just say, well, here I am in this moment. I'm looking at the faces in the crowd and I'm reacting and I'm saying what comes to me. Because there's nothing wrong right now. I mean, that can be terrifying for some people. But when you're honest with yourself and you realize that you are already enough, then you can, it's pretty easy to speak. So well done on you for that. That would be a hell of a moment to be thrown in.
This is where we go into voting and elections and a lot of the interactions that volunteers are going to be having trying to convince other people to vote, or to not just to convince them to vote, but you know, who to vote for. People come in with their own kind of internal rubric and script that they've built through life. I'm a businessman, I'm a student, I'm a this, I'm a that, which means that I react in all these situations in this way. And part of what you do when you first walk into an improv class is help people feel comfortable enough to stop playing their script in order to play whatever the scene and whatever they're getting thrown to. What are some of the ways that you help people ease into that so that they can let go of their own personal identity in order to get into the moment of interacting with whatever is coming at them from the world?
Well, in a scene or in an improv class, the first thing I try and instill is that it's all going to be okay. You're going to fail when you improvise. You always will in some level, right? But that's built in. It's one of the great freedoms, is the freedom to fail. And failure is a wonderful teacher. You will also succeed, and you will learn, and you will move forward. It varies from room to room, just like I imagine at the polls, it will vary from person to person. What I would say is, like, if you're talking to someone, first listen to them, right? What are they saying? Because they're probably going to tell you more about what you want to know about them in that moment than you realize. Mm-hmm. If you come in with a script that worked for someone else, it may not work for this person, mm-hmm. right? So listen to them. They're probably going to give you an in. They're going to tell you, you're going to reveal something about themselves. You're like that. Or, this is what you seem to respond to. And the more you do that with different people, the more you'll sort of build your own kind of internal book about how to react to different types of people. Mm-hmm. Because again, if you're really listening, people are usually telling you more than you know.
Wow. When you're actively engaging in listening, what are some of the things that are running through your mind that you're listening for? What are the things that set off your, you know, spidey senses, things that you're like logging to say, okay, this is helping me understand your identity better?
Well, when I say listening, I'm also watching. Listening is the whole perception package. Just like, all right, if I'm teaching a class, I can see who's making faces. I can see how people react. Just a reaction tells me how someone feels about something I just said. You might see a person nodding their head or all of a sudden make a confused face. And you're like, oh, okay, that didn't hit home with that person. So let me try a different way with this. So you read the room. Like, who am I talking to? In improv, I've always thought, like, I think in teaching in general, your passion should be mostly for the person in front of you and, you know, and secondarily for what you already know. I mean, I already know the stuff I know. I'm here to teach you. So it doesn't matter how much I know. What matters is how much can I get you to learn from me? Mm-hmm. So again, you listen, you watch. They're going to tell you.
You said something really powerful right there. Because I think that sometimes you talk with some educators and of course they know what they know. But what you said was, how much can I get you to learn from me? Instead of how much I can just tell you. Like, how do you make that fine distinction between those two?
Well, I think, like, for a lot of teachers, when I think they first start teaching, they want to demonstrate how much they know, to sort of prove that they deserve to be teaching. Whereas that really isn't particularly useful to a student. If I see a student and I say something and they don't understand it, I need to see that. I need to hear that. Because then I can say, okay, that, like I said, that didn't land home. That's okay. I'll say it another way, right? Because again, if I'm teaching a class, they're not going to learn everything I know. Mm-hmm. They're going to learn what they're able to learn in that time. So my focus is more on them because I already know what I know. So my focus isn't on me or proving myself. My focus is on them and what I see that they're taking in. Mm-hmm. Again, the passion should be more for the student than for what you already know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Now, your path of improv comes from, you have a long line of in this art form. How have you seen it change from in the beginnings when you were starting to learn this process to where it is now, where it's now starting to see it on TV and people are acknowledging it as an art form that people want to, you know, that millions of people want to pay to see?
It's grown like a, you know, it's a bad time to use the term, but it's grown like a virus. I mean, it's spread like a virus because it's a wonderful, joyful thing. And it's growing. When I started, there was maybe two schools in the world where you could study long form improvisation, and they were both a mile apart in Chicago. Now you can't, you know, go anywhere without finding some sort of improv scene. Mm-hmm. You know, before Whose Line, you know, short form wasn't really on television, but now it is. Because that's where, like, because they're in improv in the history, you know, first it was just theater games, and this is a really truncated version. It was basically theater games or, you know, improv games to get ideas for shows. And then there was short form, which is games that are played with a set of rules. That's Whose Line Is It Anyway? And out of short form, then there becomes the idea, well, let's do it longer. Let's see how much more we can get out of this. And people started creating longer shows with less and less rules. As far as like you have to do this or you have to do that, it's like, no, let's just start playing, inventing, and recognizing the connections we make as we make them and build something. So it's grown exponentially since I started. And it's a wonderful thing to see. I used to say, you know, half joking when I was, you know, in my 20s doing this, it's like people would ask me, why do you improvise? And I'd say, to heal the world. Because eventually the idea is, you know, I'm listening to someone else. I'm caring more about the other person on stage than I am myself. These are not terrible, you know, ideas to bring into your life when you're trying to communicate with somebody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like sometimes, like, I think that quite honestly, it is healing of the world. Like I do know of a few politicians that are on the low taking improv classes, that are getting instruction, because what they're finding is that, you know, if you have to deliver a stump speech, especially with the digital world, everybody's heard your stump speech the first time you give it. But being able to listen in more town hall and more living room formats, having to address all the questions and experiences that a person gives you right there in the moment makes you have to think on your feet and come up with an answer right then and there, which is essentially what we're doing every time we get on stage.
On stage, a lot what you're doing, and I think what you're talking about in part is like, it's an exercise in finding where our agreement is. Mm-hmm. It's like, and basically in communicating with another human being, it's a lesson my mom taught me when I was a kid. It's like, you want to first find something in what they're saying that you agree with. Find a way to begin from a place of agreements before you start saying whatever it is you intend to say. Mm-hmm. People don't like to, like, 'cause like if someone is attacking you, it's our habit to become defensive and to get into a defensive mode. And then, you know, too often we wind up attacking back rather than taking a pause and saying, wait a minute, why is this person attacking me? What's going on here? Right? How can I, where's our agreement so that we can find a way to move forward so that we're not just fighting right now? Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's all I have to say on that.
In our really polarized society right now, that's a powerful lesson, because so many times we look at folks that are, we especially see it on the late night shows or on the cable news shows, but even in everyday interactions where people are coming from two sides of the political spectrum, people aren't finding agreement. And I think that that's one of those things where if you're talking about healing the nation, what are some of the ways that a person can, like, if we want to teach people a quick exercise to how to find agreement, how would someone start to play with their family to try to find agreement, to learn how to express that out in the world when they're talking to folks that are far away from them politically or socially or anything else?
Well, there are probably old, I mean, I remember the old exercises to teach agreement, like there's a game called the ad game, which I don't particularly like, but it's a fun little exercise where basically you're trying to create an ad for a product, and no matter what it is, you have to, like, hey, we're going to sell, you know, houses to birds. So how do we do that? How do we market it? And no matter what anyone says, you have to say, that's a great idea, and add to it. And we're going to keep building this ad campaign, always accepting what anyone puts in. An easier game that a family can play, that's actually, it's the same kind of, it's a similar thing. It's just when you create a story one word at a time. Mm. You can go back and forth with one person, or you can do it, you know, in the round or whatever, however many people you have, but you only get one word each. So you have to accept the word before and add the next word. And, you know, the story gets built, not just by you, but by everyone. You know, personally, like I've always enjoyed the sort of by myself, I sort of think about, everyone says everything for a reason. Mm-hmm. No matter how simple it is, there was a reason they said it. What was that reason? Why would someone say that? And just sort of exploring that in my mind about why would someone say, like, right down to a simple thing, like if someone says, you know, it sure is a nice day, it's like, why'd they say that to me? I mean, it's a really sort of, I'm being very picayune in that moment, but I'm just like, why would they say that to me? What would be the reason? And to me, it's just like, what they want from me is for me to validate their perception of the day. Mm. What they want is for me to say, yep, it sure is. So this is a good thing, right? That's not particularly revealing, but it's just an example. It's a demonstration of the sort of the analysis of any given spoken thing. Because to me, I truly do believe everyone says everything for a reason. Otherwise, mm-hmm. why would they be saying it? Mm-hmm. There's some reason, and some reasons are very important or much more complex, but there's always a reason. It could be very simple, could be very complex, but it's fun to explore.
Mm-hmm. Having this mindset where you're exploring why someone says everything, when did that develop as a mindset? Is that something you walked into improv with? Is it something you developed through improv? Or is it like from reading that you have that?
It's something that occurred to me as I was studying improv, mm-hmm. And trying to get better at it, because I wasn't very good at it. And I was asking, why are these other people better at this than me? What are they hearing that I'm not hearing? Mm-hmm. Why do they know what to say when I don't know what to say? Mm-hmm. I sort of, as a self analysis, I was like, well, what was said, and what if I take a moment that I watched, like, he said this, and then this person said this, and I wouldn't have thought of that. Why did that occur to them? What did they hear? So I started analyzing what was said, mm-hmm. And what could be heard, and what could be assumed. Mm-hmm. So to speak, I started to hear more. Mm-hmm. So it definitely came out of the study. I did not walk in with that. Mm-hmm. It was just sort of an exercise. One of many exercises I put myself through to try and get better.
Mm-hmm. I do a lot of that as well. I got that from reading some books on neuro-linguistic programming and some psychology, where they say everybody, when we are all communicating, when we're all speaking or anything, we're trying to meet some sort of want or need, whether it's conscious or unconscious. We're all just trying to meet a need, because we start out on this planet as babies and we're just need machines. And all we know how to do is to translate our sensations into sound. So if you're happy, you laugh. If something is upsetting you, you cry. If you need like food or to relieve yourself, you either just relieve yourself or you holler so that somebody will let you do that. And we do that as we get older, except for then society gives us ways to control our sound to better communicate specifically what the sensation is that we want or the need or want met. And that's what words are, is just our way of controlling our innate ability to make that sound, to share with you, hey, this is the need. I need to communicate to feel validation. I need to be seen. I need water. I need food. Whatever it is that we have built into our need database that we're meeting. And that people really just don't say anything for no reason. There's something either conscious or subconscious that is saying, I am saying this for something. And one of the beautiful things about improv is that I found that you play a lot of times with your subconscious. When you're on stage, the way that you view the world is kind of what you bring there unconsciously and subconsciously, because you get rid of your script. And I've also found that that's what happens in politics, that people are communicating with a politician specifically because they have some sort of need that they want this person in power to meet. And so it's powerful to hear you speak to that way of listening for why is it that they said that? What is the need or want that they're trying to get met?
Yeah, it's an interesting exploration. And I feel for politicians just because, one, like if a politician or anyone really was talking to one person, right, that's so much easier than having to address the needs and wants of so many people. It's like the their words become so measured. You know, you have to follow your platform. You have to, you know, it's like there's very, it's very strict, it seems, what they have to go through to be as clear as they can to so many people. As far as like the people across, you know, the nation, one improv exercise that I find useful is when I'm playing a character who's doing something that I wouldn't do, I want to understand my character better. Mm-hmm. And so what I ask myself is, how was this person raised and what events shaped them? Because to me, that explains everyone. Everyone to me is the way they are because of the way they were raised and the events that shaped them. No child is born racist. Mm-hmm. They learn that somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, who taught them that? And then if it gets larger, it's like, well, what is the larger structure that is causing this person to teach that to their children, right? And what caused that larger structure? And you keep going back for the on the larger scale, mm-hmm. but for the character, it's just like, well, how were they raised? Mm-hmm. What events probably made them this way? I don't think, I'm going to swear, but I don't think people intend to grow up to be assholes. Just some do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like, if you take a baby that's born in America and then instantly take it to Japan, it's not going to come out speaking English. It's going to speak Japanese because that's what everybody around it is speaking. The American spirit that we all have, or the Japanese spirit or the Chinese spirit, or whatever it is, it comes from the fundamental story that whatever that country has built for their people, and then they matriculate that down into the rearing of a child. And it's something that you said earlier about how you're building a story in the exercise where you're talking about a family and you're building a story one word at a time. In some respects, that's what we're all doing as citizens of a country, is that in one moment together, we're building this country, this belief, this entity, this organization, one person, one action, one thing at a time. Whether you're on stage and building it one line at a time to build a scene, or you're building a company and each one building their own contributions in order to make that company actually work, or to build a country where you're believing in this little green piece of paper that becomes the story that says this means this, so I can buy this or use this service or entity. We're all just building the story together, but most of us aren't conscious of it all the time.
I think what you said made me think something that I think is interesting, is that as a country, I think in terms of improv, just because I think about improv a lot, mm-hmm. It's like, I think a lot of people reach a place where they can imagine or conceive of a way the country should be or could be or should be in their mind. And once they have that sort of that conception in their mind, they want it to be so. So, but they don't realize that, hey, the country is, if it's a long form, we're still building it, mm-hmm. scene by scene, you know, moment by moment. It's like, it's not done, right? And to me, it's like the country isn't perfect. I was raised to believe it's the best thing going, but it's certainly not perfect. It certainly can be improved upon. The show's not over, right? Mm-hmm. The piece isn't done. We're still building it. I think people get frustrated because I want the piece to end this way. And it's like, well, the piece isn't over. Mm-hmm. We'll see where it ends. If you have a place you want it to be, well, just be in the moment. Make the next scene a move toward that thing. But, you know, it's not going to happen immediately.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting that you say that. It feels like us as human beings are, like, they have that old saying, life is a stage. Or the world is a stage and we're all but players. And if you start an improv show, you get on there and you start a scene, whatever the rules are for whatever that show is, that somebody that the players all agree to beforehand. In some cases, they just like, give me a suggestion, and then they make up a show completely. Form, formats, edits, and all that. In some ways, that's what, you know, the founding fathers were a bunch of dudes who were fighting, who were just trying to get a deal between the 13 of them or the 13 colonies. And they all had competing interests because they all had different ways that each of those colonies functioned, made money, made decisions, everything else. And we have this reverential thing for them in believing that, no, this thing is right, and we just need to follow the exact rules that they set down. But they were like, nah, we were just trying to get a deal across. We knew all this was going to screw up, and we knew all this was going to change. Like, how does the world that we live in now, where everything is changing so quickly, because, you know, it's not where the founding fathers, when they were writing this thing, they had to dip a quill in a piece of paper, and then somebody had to like handwrite it. Mm-hmm. And then you couldn't like, it was no Google Docs where you could be like, no, let's edit that. Let's get rid of that 3/5 compromise real quick. It was like, nah, do you know how long it took me to write this whole thing out? And like every time having a dip, we didn't have a Bic pen back then. Like, how does going forward, do you think that improv will help shape the way that people think, people talk, people act, and how people govern?
I think the more improv spreads, the more it becomes common, you know, even more so than it is. My hope would be that people would listen to each other better, learn from each other more. I think, you know, like, and I'm a product of this, you know. To me, it feels like when I grew up, it felt like the Constitution was a million years ago. It's like it was impossibly ancient. It's not that old. Our country's not that old. And the Constitution, by the way, has had amendments. It's like, because we've recognized along the way that things have changed, like certain other things need to be addressed. That's why I hate the phrase and the idea of like someone who says they're a constitutional literalist, like they want to go by the strict, you know, exact thing that was said in the Constitution. I'm just like, well, why would you want to be that inflexible? Why would you? The Constitution should be seen as a living document that can be changed if need be, right? There's an old quote I used to like. I'm not sure if I remember it right. I'm not even sure who said it. I think maybe it was. Was it Hamilton or I can't remember, or it was someone in that time frame. I think it was Andrew Jackson. But anyway, the quote was, all societies that come into being and are maintained by the people's acceptance of certain moral standards. These standards exist and cannot be displaced. They are greater indeed than we are. Now, I liked that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I said, yes, but the standards, you know, they change. Our moral awareness changes, mm-hmm. right? So why should any one document be done? Be like, well, now this is in stone. This is forever. It's like, yeah, but time's changed. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know there was some messed up stuff in the original Constitution. Mm-hmm. And we're like, yeah, but all right, we changed that, but nothing else. We're not going to change anything else. It's like, why? It's like, if it comes time to change it, change it. So I find that very frustrating. I hope people, because I see it in terms of like, as I view that in terms of improv, I don't like playing improv in any way that I feel it limits me. Mm-hmm. That's why I don't like doing forms as much as I like just playing and seeing what happens. I don't like doing something where I have to follow the rules to such a degree that it keeps me from reacting and doing what occurs to me. Mm-hmm. That to me is a more joyous freedom than accomplishing a set form. And I think, you know, I think that's what we should be doing. We should, the Constitution is it's like the rule of yes and in improv. It's not absolute, right? Mm-hmm. It's a good idea. It's a good, the idea that you're not supposed to argue in improv, really good idea, right? But it's not absolute. There are times when you should. So why make the Constitution an absolute, right? There are certainly things that need, that can be addressed in it, maybe updated, maybe fixed, maybe changed, amended, whatever it is. I don't want to play in a world where, hey, the rules are set in stone forever, even though the world keeps changing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do see some of those folks that no matter what piece of information gets dropped, the thing is, the thing they came up with first, you see this on stage too, the thing they came up with first is the thing that we're going with no matter what. And right. It's like we're seeing that kind of play out in our national patina where, you know, we're getting new information about this virus every single day, this thing that's less than a year old. And some folks have like developed their wisdom that this is how, you know, we don't need masks because I don't believe it. I'm just not going to believe it.
What's kind of sad and funny about that is that there was a point at which science basically said that it seemed that masks aren't really an effective tool. And I think a lot of people just said, all right, fine. That's what I believe. But then science, you know, learned and changed and said, wait a minute, we've studied this more. Masks are an effective tool. But then some people were like, nope, I believe the first thing. It's just like, well, wait a minute, but that changed. It's like we learned more. It changed. And then there are people who are like, no, but you said, and they'll like hold someone's foot to the fire about it. It's like, you said this, so you were wrong. It's like, that's what we knew at the time. Mm-hmm. Now we know more, so now we're changing our opinion. That's science.
And you know what's funny is, and if you go back and you actually listen to the words of Dr. Like, I've heard Dr. Fauci talk about, you know, the first time he was talking about masks and then where they got to. If you listen to his subtext, you understand that that was one of those dad lies. Like, yeah, we took the dog to a farm and we dropped right. him off there. Cause it was like, we didn't know, we knew masks were effective, i.e. that's why we had surgeons and everywhere else using masks, but we didn't have enough masks for everybody. And we knew if we gave it to everybody, we wouldn't have enough for the surgeons, doctors, and other people who were working to actually save lives. He has said that in subtext, like, yeah, we didn't have the supply back then. And so folks took that as the word of science because basically, they right. were protecting, they were trying to save lives, the more essential lives. And then people just hung on to that thing and said, nope, that's what he said. Nope, I'm not listening to anything else he said except for that thing he said that conveniently sticks with the thing that I want.
Well, that's it too, right there, is that what people are doing is they're hearing what they want. I mean, they're listening to things they agree with and dismissing things they don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
dumb.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to function in a place where you hold so firmly on your ideas and your thoughts that makes you so you like sometimes even virtually put your fingers in your ear, the ears that you can't hear what the other person is saying, because you just are screaming over and over again this thing that you already believe.
Yeah, you're not listening. Mm-hmm. That's the last you've heard me say it in class, where it's like thinking can be noise. Mm-hmm. It's like because we all do it, we all have the experience of we're talking to someone and they're saying something to us, and we think we already get their point. We start preparing to say what we're going to say back. And at that point, we're not really listening to them anymore. So we're not really taking in what else they might be telling us.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's the in 2008, they used to call me the Republican Whisperer because one of the things
I have no idea what that means. That could be a good thing or a horrible thing.
Well, it's like the dog whisperer. So I was at the Obama campaign offices, and so sometimes people would get on the phone and we were calling. This was back before there was advanced analytics. So it was like, if they got a phone number, we're calling. And that was analytics. We generated the data in analytics by calling everybody. So it was like the Obama campaign had better polling numbers than anybody because they didn't do sample sizes. They just called everybody. Right. So it's like, we're going to know. And so people would put me on the phone if they talked to somebody that was still listening and conversing, but they couldn't actually, you know, Republicans that were like engaging, but they couldn't get through to. Because what I found is that sometimes liberals making phone calls and conservatives making phone calls have their idea of what is right. And so they can't listen to the other person and like to let go of the thing that you've got in order to help give them new information to see a different point of view. Because they're so, it's like the alarm bell goes off and they're like, I can't hear. Like, I think one particular instance was, there was a guy that was talking about drilling at Anwar, because in 2008, I guess that was a thing, is that people were really concerned about drilling in the Atlantic National Reserves in Alaska. And this person was like on the phone and they were like, you know, that's going to, that's not going to drop our gas prices. That guy was like, I want to drill there, so it will drop our gas prices and all this other stuff, because they were conservative. And the person that was talking to them kept talking about the polar bears and what if there's a spill and like, right, clearly stuff that person does not care about.
Right.
Because that person is like not see polar bears. And so in listening with them, the things that I could hear were the fear that they had about the world, gas prices and all this other stuff. So I was able to address with them and listen like, hey, you know, I hear the thing that you're talking about is, you know, making sure that America is the strongest. I'm like, yeah, you know, we got to protect ourselves. You know, we got to be safe and all this other stuff. And I was like, hey, if we drill in Anwar now, while it is, we're going to be tapping into all of our reserves. That's like we're going to be using up our bank account that we could be using long term. And we won't have that for the future where other countries that we're buying in our oil and using our oil, when they start shutting the spigots off. And this person was like, well, I hadn't thought about that. And just the simple action of coming from a point of view that, yeah, okay, the thing that you're talking about is being safe in national security and gas prices. If I can help you, if I can frame you, the thing that you want, which is both of what we want, is, well, I want not to drill there. And what you want to do is just get all the energy. If I can help you see where getting the thing I want gets you what you want, we can both be happy. But
yeah, and that's an example of good listening. He was telling you what he was worried about.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you're right. He wasn't concerned about the extinction of polar bears or anything like that. And he's like, no, I'm concerned about being strong. Right. And so basically, and you could shift that in another way. The first thing that occurred to me is like, you realize that our environment makes us strong. It's like, if we weaken our environment, it's like, look at all the places in the world where they've ruined their land by over lumbering. I don't even think that's the word, not lumbering. What is the car? When they deforest, by cutting down all their damn trees. And then the earth becomes no good there. It's like, yeah, but exactly what you did, basically, it's like, put that in terms of this makes us strong.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because that's what he was telling you he was worried about. So good on you.
Mm-hmm. You know, and pivoting a little bit, one of the things that, your theater has done, which has been amazing, is that in this pandemic, you guys shifted from, you know, you're a theater. Everything you do is on usually on the stage and in person. And you've made a sharp pivot to actually now being online and offering courses and trainings and shows 7 nights a week right on Twitch, live where anybody can join in. What were some of the things or the learnings that you did in shift? Because political campaigns are doing the same thing now. Like they're going from, you know, rallies and coffee talks and all this other stuff to needing to figure out, how do I do this online? How do I reach and engage people from where they are?
Well, the learning for me anyway, was just recognizing how incredibly effective and useful this technology is. Mm-hmm. It's like, I was, before I taught my first class online, back in my head, I was like, I don't know if this is going to work, because I think I need to be in the room. I think I need to, you know, I don't know if I'll hear or see enough to be able to effectively teach. And then I taught that first class and I was like, holy shit, this works. I can hear you. I can see your face. In a way, this works better. And also, it opens it up to the world. Something there, and to me, a lot of what's been happening as far as like the shows going online, that's the credit to our artistic director, Alyssa Phillips, and all the people who jumped on board with like, yeah, let's put shows online. Because that became its own job and challenge. Mm-hmm. But again, it's proved like, hey, this actually, it's like the shows, it's harder. I think it's harder to do an improv show online. Mm-hmm. Or even, it's just, you're putting up a show and you're in boxes and like, that's hard. Teaching, it seems more effective. But some shows work online. It depends on, you know, I think the challenge is like, so here's our stage. This is now our stage. So what's the most effective way to use this stage? Like, I don't want to bother. To me, it's like, I think like one of the first show I did online, like in this format, I did the show Heather and Miles with me and Heather Ann Campbell. And we said, well, this is our format. So let's make the format part of the show. So our show was a FaceTime call with a person in space and a person back on Earth. That was built into the show. So we'll take a suggestion and see wherever the conversation leads us, but the format didn't work against us. Mm-hmm. Whereas like I've seen people, like, it's funny, I was teaching a class the other day and two people tried to do like a fighting scene. And it's like, one, it's hard enough to pull off a fight on stage when you're improvising. And two, you're basically two people standing there with their hands up pretending like they're fighting. It's like, no one buys this. You're not fooling anybody. So for right now, anyway, for me, I'm not focusing so much on the physical work as I am just the character work, the facial work, the vocal work, the mental understanding of what's going on, you know, what you can hear, what you can't hear. But yeah, it's like even here talking with you, I so much prefer this format to a phone call because I can see you, right? I can see how you react to what I'm saying. I've had the experience personally where if I'm sitting here on my patio, if I'm having a drink and I'm talking to a friend, it feels almost like I'm in a bar. Mm-hmm. It's like, cause we're hanging out, we're talking to each other. Mm-hmm. I can see them. They can see me. Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing.
You know, I think that's what's going to happen is a lot of what you did in improv. It's funny to think of how improv has changed, because at some point somebody had to develop for the folks at home. There's different tools in improv that's it's its own language that we all use. Things like sweep edits and tag outs and time cuts and time jumps. So that we can communicate to the players on stage to make, to progress the storyline if we're doing that sort of improv together. And once you learn it all together, you start using it. And sometimes you're inventing stuff on the fly. Mm-hmm. And I think that what's going to happen is that there's going to be, somebody's going to become the digital family and figure out, like you guys did the improvised movie and all these different formats where you literally develop the language of improv to do on stage together that everyone else then learned how to do. Somebody is going to sit down and figure out how to do jump cuts, how to do time cuts, how to change backgrounds, how to signify, so that as a show, you are able to take advantage of the medium and do different things to advance and also to do things that other people didn't think of, because before they were just like, I guess you and I can just talk in this box. How do we play with this more in order to make it so that it's more than just us playing with this box?
It's interesting because in a parallel to the pandemic, it's like the pandemic has forced scientists from around the world to work together more to try and come up with a vaccine. So I think that's why we're seeing more options for potential vaccines appearing sooner than they normally would. Mm-hmm. And in a similar way, being forced online to perform, it's like, well, you don't have any other option. So now you're sort of forced into a place where you have to invent a way to figure this out. Because there's an age-old question in long-form improv. It's like, this doesn't translate to television. There's never been a successful long-form improv show on television. But if you can make it work online, that's basically television. You figured it out. So now we're all stuck in this box trying to figure out how can this be done, right? So mm-hmm. I look forward to seeing what might happen.
That's what we should do, is just go get an all-star team of improvisers together and be like, hey guys, we're just going to do a workshop. We're going to work this out. We're going to figure out how to use Zoom and OBS and all this other stuff together. And we're going to figure out how to do the best half-hour show and then sell that as a pitch, because every single week we don't have to hire writers because we are the writers. And we break the format where everybody else is like, oh my God, I can do this from home.
Right. And it's funny, there are some shows that work online pretty good, some that don't. And it's like, that's the process. You trial and error, trying to figure it out. I don't have the answers for that yet. I think first, just know that this is now your stage. Mm-hmm. So it's like in improv classes, they used to tell you to, it's kind of a BS exercise, but they'd say, explore the space, move around the space. So you basically walk around the room and whatever, explore the space, even though you knew it was a box. It's like, yeah, it's a box. It's like, this is our new box. Just like, this is the space, you know, in a way, explore the space. What can you do in this space? And it becomes tricky because a lot of what you just said is you got to learn how to do a bunch of technical things that a lot of improvisers don't know how to do. So that's going to become, you know, the more this grows, that will become a more sought after skill, because it might not even be an improviser. It'll probably be some combination of performer who's also really savvy with tech that will come up with a way to make it work. Mm-hmm. Because I haven't seen it yet. I've seen some things that are okay, but it's not an easy nut.
Oh yeah, I think it's like it's one of those things where some videographer and digital producer is going to walk into an improv class and take it and be like, oh, I got it, because you guys have been using this way, but we've been using this way, and so let's marry this.
Right.
And then they'll probably come up with a bunch of keyboard shortcuts to help everybody be able to tap in. And so that you could essentially do all the stuff that you were doing But we'll have to learn how to use sound cues and everything else. Like maybe you hit tag and everybody freezes and they were like, all right, you're now a Loch Ness monster. And I guess this is one of those funny things where politicians are having to do the same thing because they are going from town halls to in these little boxes. And I was just discussing with a friend of mine who is talking with teachers who had to go from standing in front of a classroom, because a lot of them have, a lot of teachers have the ability to project authority because they're wearing a tweed jacket and they're standing in front of the class while everyone else is sitting. Well, now they're in the same size box as everybody else. And they have to learn how to communicate in such a way that projects that they are the person that's in charge and that they know the most, even though they are just one of many boxes. And so they don't have that power position that they would normally have that gives, I should listen to this person. They have to bat down the, it's almost the same thing on a Facebook thread where you're like, okay, we're all just typing in this box. And some people understand words that come out and some people are like, nah, you're just typing in the same box as me.
Right. That's funny. I don't really think of like, I've had to establish that I'm the authority in a class. And to me, I almost work the opposite way. Like if I was in a real-time class with a stage, right? The only time I'm standing on the stage and talking to the students is if I'm trying to show something. Mm-hmm. Otherwise I'm sitting. And I'm probably sitting on the edge of the stage. It's sort of like you want it to be more like, no, we're all the same. I just happen to know more than you right now. But I don't think if I have to establish my authority. I certainly don't dress like I'm trying to establish my authority. so I don't think of it in that traditional structure. Mm-hmm. Like you're in a class I'm teaching right now. I don't think I have to establish my authority in that class. I think, well, to me, it's like if people signed up for the class, they know you're teaching it. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of a given.
Well, you'd be surprised. It's like a lot of time. Well, it's some, I'm the thing, the perspective, I guess I learned from, because I was talking with a student at Bryn Mawr, who's like the head of the peer mediator. She's been teaching teachers how to transition their college classes from online to from the classroom to online because they would have terrible mics. They're positioning over the screen. Like they didn't know how to use any of the technical stuff. And the thing that's going on in the back of some of the students' minds are like, man, if this person doesn't know how to do something as simple as a video call, then how are they going to teach me, you know, physics? It's like, yeah. Dude, and I hadn't thought of that until I was like, oh, huh. That's, and so I guess the teachers were sometimes getting challenged like that because of that. And so it's like, they have to actually learn how to command that room and that presence so that they can actually impart that knowledge that they have to the other students.
That's interesting. Because again, I don't think of it that way because I think it's pretty, like, I'm not particularly tech savvy. I learned the basics of how to start my Zoom meeting and get people in there and to tell people to turn off their mics and cameras, you know, some basic stuff you need to do to make it work. But I don't see, because I think like in the community at my theater, I think people know that I'm pretty not tech savvy. Like I'm not on Twitter really, except very occasionally. It's like, I'm not the tech guy. And to me, I'm fine with that. Cause like, that's not my field of expertise. There are people who are good at that. I am not. But that doesn't, I don't feel that takes away from what I do know. I can see if you were completely inept, like if every class I taught, I was like this, you know, then I'm just like, all right, so I need to learn to do that. Otherwise, I'm just, I look dumb. So if that's your point, then yeah, you have to at least know the basics.
Editor's note. That Miles and I are referring to is lifting the camera so only part of your head is displayed.
Mm-hmm. I'll say, I have a friend that does do that. That's how they do all of their video calls. I'm like, I wonder if this is, you know, you're doing this at work and people are not telling you that, you know, you need to put your screen the right way because this is how we all work now.
Right. It's like, and it can be small things that people do naturally. Like right now I'm sitting in a chair, not in a particularly comfortable position because I'm leaning forward because of my screen. But if I just did something like this.
Editor's note. The like this is Miles sitting all the way back in his chair.
This is a much less effective way for me to talk to you because I'm farther away. You can't see me as well. Right? Like you and I right now are in what I would say about the right, you know, frame and light. We can see each other. So it can be very small things like that. Like, you know, be aware of how you look on screen. Not so much like, how, you know, do you look good or not? It's like, no, do you look clear? Can people see you? Because I do see that in class sometimes. And I have to remind some people because they got something like this going on. And I'm just like, that just looks weird to me.
And for the audio, hold on. For the audio listeners, I want to say what he did was panned and tilted his computer up, so all you saw was the top of his head, as you'll see in many Zoom conferences. We'll put a screen grab in the show notes so that you guys can see what we're talking about.
Yeah, an example of what not to do in your Zoom meeting.
Now, one last point before we do our vote plan, because I know that I only scheduled you in for an hour and we're already going. I don't know if I don't want to kill your whole day because I can talk to you forever because you're brilliant and amazing.
I'm fine. I'm just sitting on my patio, man. I ain't going nowhere.
So one of the things that I always talk about is that I love to illuminate is character isn't what you do when everyone's watching. Character is what you do when no one's watching. And one of the things that you have right now is an amazing, you're teaching a class of folks of diverse backgrounds that pretty much the only people that know about it are the people that are in the class and a few other people in the communities in like South LA and East LA that we've reached out to. And I want to thank you because that's a powerful thing to do. A class where you're teaching the skills of improv to folks that haven't been exposed to it. As you saw in the class, some of these folks had never even heard of improv, period.
Right.
Have you learned anything from that experience or in that class that's different than when you're teaching a normal improv class?
It forces me to go back to the beginning more than usual. Usually when I'm teaching, people are more familiar and my teaching is more advanced. So it forced me to kind of go back to like the basics of agreements and what's important about that. So that, you know, that's whenever you're forced to re-examine something, you hopefully are learning. It reiterated in me that like some people who don't know about improv are wonderful because the first, what they do is they react and listen and say the first thing that occurs to them, which is beautiful. Whereas people who know a little bit more try to think themselves to a better them, which you can't do when you're playing. And you usually wind up screwing up a scene. It also becomes, I want to thank you for helping me get that going. Cause it's something, it's the kind of thing I've wanted to do for years, but it was just the logistics of it weren't possible. But again, one of the blessings of being forced online is like, hey, I can now teach to people anywhere. As long as they can get access to, you know, a device, I can teach them. So that's been wonderful. And again, cause again, it feels aside from like those small things, it feels like pretty much any class I teach, it's just like, I'm gonna try and teach the people in front of me what I think I can teach them today. Mm-hmm. And so far, people seem to be digging it. So wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know that some of the folks are using the things that they've learned, especially about listening, in their community organizing and community engagement work, and probably what we'll end up doing, some of the voter registration and passing. Like one of the people in there is working on passing the bill to end Prop 13, which is that law that makes it so that companies in California that have basically that have these legacy corporations, big giant corporations that hold, that have been paying the same tax since like 1978 on land that's worth millions, in some case billions, but they're like, right, nope, we're paying the 1978 tax on this bad boy, which means that we have so many underfunded liabilities in our state. And they're like using this in their organizing work and communications work, in addition to one day when they pop up on your screen or on your stage. It's like, it's been life changing. Like, I've been hearing a lot of thank you. So I want to pass that on to you as a thank you. And also one other thing, the work the theater has been doing, in addition to establishing a diversity and inclusion board, an inclusivity board, to make it a more hospitable place for folks of every race, creed, color, gender, identity, class, and everything, is like, Alyssa, the artistic director, has been going around and helping out Black businesses specifically with their social media. It's one of those, it's one of those things where sometimes where improv plays into the general world, where you learn, improv is the place where you learn that you are enough and that everything you say is gold. And for a long time in this country, the only people that have felt that way are, you know, white men. They say, they walk into every room. Mm-hmm. They don't have to be a different person when they walk into a room. They're just like, right, dude, I'm a white dude. What I say, go. And so a lot of improv for a long time was just white dudes. And so that transition to where everyone is learning their opinions, their thoughts, their feelings are valid. And for a long time, folks learned, I can't promote myself. I can't talk. I may be the best chef in the world, but it feels bad to actually proclaim my best chefery, because people have taught me self-promotion is evil, self-promotion is bad. Whereas, you know, white dudes are like, no, I'm the greatest in the world. You should know that. So it's really powerful to have Alyssa going around and showing folks the power of telling people about their businesses.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's also a very good example of that something she's good at, right? So she's taking something she's good at and finding a way to help, to reach out. And that's, to me, it's like, in the simplest terms, it's like, you do what you can. There are, mm-hmm, some things I can do, some things I can't do. It's like, well, I can teach, so I'll do that. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that that's what people should be trying to do, is like, cause again, it's like, I haven't been to a protest because me and my wife are both high risk and we have children. I'm just like, sorry, the lives of my children, are my priority, but it doesn't mean I can't do something. Mm-hmm. It's like, so what can I do? Right. So again, you do what you can in the very least. Mm-hmm. I think she's she's out there doing that. If she can do it, she's doing it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, she's like, I literally got an email from her at 1 o'clock this morning, because we're talking about doing a thread on the channel, on the Twitch stream, for voter reg to underserved and very difficult to reach communities. And like, now I'm going to reach out to my friends that are experts in voter reg to see how we can make that happen. But it's like, she's tireless, and it's powerful that you've built the theater in such a way that it recruits those sorts of people that are tireless in helping and including everybody else. Because, you know, that's, if you go to some places, it's a bunch of mercenaries. And I'm not talking about the theater community as a whole, but I'm talking about in life, because everything is just an organization. An organization is just a collection of people with a set of rules that they use to play what game. This is the theater game that people play. And, you know, there's the I work for Netflix game where the head of the company says, you know, my greatest competition is sleep. And it's like, those folks are going to have a different value when they show up to do the things that they want to do. And the fact that you've fostered this environment where they've all taken on the same mantle of how can I contribute? How can I listen? How can I do my part? I don't want to say little part, because some parts are not, it's not little, it's just adding in. If you're trying to bake a cake and all you got is sugar, that's a big part to bring to that cake making. But somebody else might like, oh, is all you have is sugar? It's like, dude, you didn't have any sugar. Y'all didn't have cake. You had bread.
Right. Yeah. I wish I could say I had a plan in doing this, but I didn't. My thing was, you know, I taught, and then as other people wanted to teach, I tried to get them set up. And then with people like Alyssa, she showed up and she was interested. So I'm like, all right. Mainly I try and stay out of, I think it's kind of like this, to put it simply, you know, try and surround yourself with good people and try not to get in their way. The thing I try to give to the community is space. It's like, I don't tell them what to do. I don't tell them what to put up. I don't tell my teachers what to teach. I actually specifically hire teachers that I think differently than I do. Because I would rather variety rather than one specific only way to do it. And, you know, beyond that, all I can provide is, you know, what I know, and then what little opportunity there is at the theater. Mm-hmm. I started it. If I've done anything well, it's I've tried to stay out of people's way. I've tried to let good people do good things.
Mm-hmm. And you know, in some ways, going back to elections and to our founding of our country, that's essentially what the founding fathers did when they broke away, when they wrote the words, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, to provide for the common defense, provide for our social welfare, yada yada." Yeah, I tried to do it. I couldn't do the whole thing. But
we the people, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution of the United States of America.
Bam! See,
I know that because I know that because of Schoolhouse Rock.
You know what's going to be funny is there's going to be some listeners that are like, "What Schoolhouse Rock?" because they're that young.
Look it up. It was great stuff.
But it's like in that preamble is just the setup for we're making it where this is what we're doing. We're going to try to get out the way. Here are these rules. It's almost like you go back. If those folks that are biblical, after Moses led a bunch of these people who had formerly been slaves, who had just had somebody tell them what to do for all the time, he led them across, led them through the Red Sea. They're on the other side and they're like, "Moses, dude, what?" And they're like getting him in all these fights. So he had to go up Mount Sinai and chill out for a little while, get the anxiety out of his head, talk to God. And God said, "Let me hook you up with these 10 rules. These are 10 simple rules. Tell these fools, just do this. And everything will be all right. Just you don't do these 10 things. And otherwise, you know, Big Daddy's going to come down there and they ain't going to like that. Just tell him that. Just bring these tablets down. That's good. That's all the founding fathers did, except for we had the power of reading and stuff like that, because back then slaves couldn't read. So he had to come and drop down in, and that's essentially what you've built, except for it's almost like instead of the rules being words, it's like how organizations, how governments used to be formed, where it'd be like the king, and king be like, "These are the rules of the game. This is how we play. Someone go bring me a hog that's fatted, and you know, that guy in the corner tells jokes."
It's funny because the story of Moses, I tend to think of it as the Charlton Heston movie, just because it always cracked me up. Even when I was a kid, I was just like, wait a minute. So all these people, they saw the sea part, right? They walked across the fucking sea. They saw a big gold tornado defend them. They got to the other side. The sea closed up and, you know, smote their enemies. And 5 minutes later, they're like, let's build a gold idol. It's like, wait a minute, you saw all that, right? You saw that. It's like, no, we're going to worship a gold idol. Mm-hmm. Well, that just struck me. Just that's insanity.
What have you done for me lately?
Yeah, so yeah, that, whatever. But, you know, gold.
Mm-hmm. It was like, y'all just didn't. But that's the human condition. It's like, you get there. It's like, I did all these amazing things. I delivered you. I kept y'all alive through crazy slavery. And still. Right.
It's funny. I always think, you know, the old, the story about, you know, the guy drowning and the boat comes and the surfboard, whatever. A lot of things come to potentially save them from drowning. And he just keeps saying, no, to, you know, God will deliver me or save me. Mm-hmm. And eventually dies and goes to heaven. And God's like, I sent you the boat. I sent you this. It's like, I sent you all these things to help you. And I always think about that when what else? It's like when people quote the Bible and stuff, like, yeah, he gave us reason. He gave us science, right? He gave us these ways to help ourselves. So when people are like anti-science, I'm just like, realize that, like, that's one of the gifts, mm-hmm. right? It's like, that's the boat. It's like, don't ignore it. Mm-hmm. I've always thought that. I was like, he is sending us things. We're ignoring them.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty much like gravity existed for everybody. And so he thought it'd be a good idea to actually hit Isaac Newton in the head with an apple so that Isaac Newton can say, oh yeah, let me break this down for everybody so they understand this thing that has been this invisible force. And let me go invent calculus so that they can actually reproduce this thing that we've all been subject to.
Right. Yeah, that just makes me think about how gravity is a wonderful example of, like, equality in nature. The fact that a bowling ball and a tennis ball fall at the same rate. It's like, that is equal, man. Mm-hmm. Gravity mm-hmm. is definitely equal.
Mm-hmm. 9.8 meters per second squared. That's all it is. So let's do the vote plan, because we have an election coming up on election day, November 3rd, 2020. Let's start with your name.
Mine?
Yeah.
Is that how we're doing it? Oh, okay. Miles Stroth.
All right. Yeah. And are you voting by mail or voting in person?
By mail.
Okay. And are you already registered to vote?
Yes.
Now, without saying without speaking the name of Voldemort, what's the most important reason you're voting this year?
To be heard, to vote, to take part. It's like, and yeah, Voldemort.
Now, have you already filled out your vote by mail request form?
Yes.
Do you have a 55-cent postage stamp?
Yes.
What is the date you're mailing your ballot?
I don't know offhand.
All right. Will you try to get it in by October 15th?
Yes. And I'll full transparency, my wife handles that. We get our ballots, we fill them out, and she handles that. So I'm sure it'll be done on time, but so I don't know the date.
Awesome. And all right, so I was going to ask you, where's the mailbox or post office that you'll be dropping it off? But she's going to be the one that's handling all that.
No, she'll fill it out. I'll drop it off. It's our local post office.
Okay. And will you please post a selfie at the mailbox and tag Vote Plan 2020?
Sure.
Dope. That's the vote plan. You've got a plan to go and vote. You're going to nail it down with your wife. You already got it in. The reason why we do this is because and just like you have your wife to help you out, what we found is that by a lot of folks, especially younger folks who are the most registered group, they, you know, voting is something that we do every 2 to 4 years, where we sit down all together and we remake the story of America by picking new storytellers. And a lot of times when you're younger, you've never seen the story play out. So all the things that you have in your life when you're trying to experience everything, whether it's all the cool foods, all the fun, going to concerts and everything else, having babysitters if you have a kid, and voting, because it only happens one day every other year, it falls by the wayside. So that group tends to be the one that votes the least, even though everybody has been a part of that group at some point. And older folks, by then, they have their routines down. They've voted enough times, so they don't feel intimidated. They don't feel scared by the process. And part of the reason why we have a vote plan is by making it a checklist that somebody actually puts on their refrigerator or carries around in their phone. It makes it a conscious thought more than just on November 3rd or whenever they get their ballot. And so they actually follow through on it. It's kind of like, you know, knowing the rules to doing anything makes it easier to play Candyland, Monopoly, or something else.
Right. Because
nobody wants to sit down and relearn how to play a game and spend half the time like, man, you know what? Let's go play this other game we already know how to play.
Right. Yeah, it's just like in improv terms, like you are more comfortable playing scenes you're familiar with. Right. And if you're not as familiar with the voting process as other people, then you're not going to be as comfortable in that process. So I think it's great that you're trying to make people as comfortable as possible to make it easier for them to do what they probably want to do in the first place.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, because people have a lot of good intentions, but sometimes, you know, they go and look at that gold calf and be like, I want to go do the gold calf thing. Because that's more fun. It's right in front of me. And, you know, the gold calf maker is figuring that out. He's like, you know, we're all across this sea and all. All these people are bored and angry. Why don't I hook up a gold calf? I can get somebody to give me some gold. I can get somebody to hook me up some calves. You know, ain't nobody else taking charge. Let me go ahead and take charge.
That Moses guy went up on the mountain.
Yeah.
It's like, calf time.
It's like, moo time, let's do this. You know, that's why he had to put that in. It was like, it's like a version of that is in every version of the Ten Commandments, like, or every version of a set of rules. Thou shalt not put any other gods before me. Because you need to, you know, like, no, all this, you need to pay attention to this. Because human attention is the, you know, human attention, whether it's your hands, your feet, is the one thing that we all control. What we look at, what we do with our time, how we spend our time. And all too often, how we use our human attention is so frivolous and so letting go, especially in this world where the basic needs of food, clothing, shelter, water, air, and reproduction are at so readily. We don't have to hunt for those things like we used to. So all that idle time leaves us to go look for other stuff that gets in the way of how do you bless your higher self and how do you look to the higher pursuits of our planet.
All right.
Sorry, just got on the soapbox, baby.
Yeah, I'll be honest, I'm not a particularly, you know, I'm a lapsed Catholic, and I'm not a particularly religious person, although I do think people are aware of goodness. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what they should be responding to in their lives. Because there's, you know, to me, I don't have a problem with being religious. I do have a problem with a lot of organized religion. Because mm-hmm. Again, it's in part a man-made construct that mm-hmm. that has its failings. I know it also does a lot of good, but it's like anything else. It's a living thing. It mm-hmm. should be subject to review. Otherwise, you should tell me a good price I can get for my wife.
Mm-hmm. like, I'll say, I'm along that same, I don't believe, I think that religions are just what you said. It's just an invention that somebody made. They are, you know, we are all just energy manifested as what we are. This microphone, me, you, we're the same protons, neutrons, and electrons, just arranged in some sort of fashion. Even the air that we cannot see is just that. And so what religion is at some point, there's some of us that get a chance to sit down long enough to tap into the whatever that is the controlling force that brings us all together. And they have enough knowledge to be able to translate it for the people that are around them. And they tend to mix in the challenges that are being held at that moment and fix those problems with that thing that you come from the divine, which is why when you boil down all the problems at the moment and look at the things that Buddha, Muhammad, King, Christ, Abraham, Moses, all of them said all the same stuff. It's like all of it boils down to the same stuff across religion. And every religion is just the stuff you add into that about just to make sense of what's going on to help people understand it.
Yeah, there are so many, just like the very simple lesson of do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It's like, all right, that is I have no problem with that. That's a great idea. I'm going to go with that. But, you know, there's a lot of specific stuff from it. It's like, no, not so much that. Again, you know, it's a living thing. And I think like a lot of people equate, like if someone isn't super religious, they're flawed or they're immoral. It's like, no, you can be very aware of what is the right or good thing to do in life and not be a part of any religion. Mm-hmm. Again, I think organized religion, again, because like, I fully stand by, like, you can't prove God exists. You can't prove he doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, so it's really a matter of choice. It's a matter of faith. And I begrudge no one either way they go.
Mm-hmm.
You do you.
Mm-hmm.
But organized religion, it's like, I think that's definitely a man-made construct that over the centuries has done some pretty horrendous shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of those things where God just is or isn't, because God doesn't exist, you know. God is like air. Just because you don't believe in it and can't see it don't mean it don't exist. And we all, you know, the things that we know are protons, neutrons, like our physical personhood, the energy that we are. And I don't think, you know, from my perception of what God is, it's not this thing where God takes sides. God is there when you make your free throws. God is there when you miss your free throws. You know, God is right in the locker room for the winning team. God's in the locker room for the losing team. God just was the one that said, let me get a suggestion. Okay, Earth, go. and then the rest of this just came to be.
And the show's not over.
Yeah, show's still going. Like, same thing with, you know, you look at the Founding Fathers. They took what was there and said, okay, new game. 1776, we're tired of that game. Let's all start off with the new one. This is what we want to figure out. These are what we want to play. These folks are folks. These folks are not folks. Well, we want to hold into power this stuff that this has gotten us so good here. There's a bunch of stuff we don't know, because world's going to change, because hashtag it always does. So here's this thing. Here's the rules to the game as we play now. And at some point, somebody's going to change these rules.
I think it's kind of funny, because what I perceive in our species is that every time we figure something out, we kind of think, all right, now we know everything. It's just like, wait a minute. There's a whole history of us not knowing stuff and then knowing it. But every time, it just seems like the reaction is, all right, now we know everything. It's like, no, we don't yet. Mm-mm.
Like, we're going to find out one day. It's kind of like, you know, we're going to find out that there's another species out there in the world. There's something that we couldn't see or understand because all we are big sensors. Just like different insects can actually read your aura because they're looking at something that's larger than the container that is us. They see mm-hmm. our heat patterns and whatnot. Like, we're going to find out one day that there's things that we don't see, understand, or perceive that we're communicating through and don't understand. Just like we always have. It's you know, as we get more understanding of things like dark matter, we are always continuing in growth in the way that we perceive the world. Because at some point, somebody looked at a microscope and could see the small stuff, and somebody looked at a telescope and could see the big stuff.
Right. It's funny with what I always thought about dark matter. And again, this is not something I'm not a scientist, but I always thought this about it just because it's true. It's like, all right, so wait a minute. Dark matter. We can't see it. We can't perceive it in any known way, but it has to exist. Otherwise, how we perceive the universe might be wrong. And it has to exist not just a little bit everywhere. It has to be basically all around us, all the time, you know, everywhere. Mm-hmm. Or maybe, because otherwise, our math might be wrong.
And we're going to find out that our math is wrong.
Yeah, and I'm just like, okay, that seems weird, but okay.
Because, you know, think of it. At one point, we thought we had it figured out with Newton, and then Einstein said, no, all his math is bullshit. It's like, you know what he didn't take into account was the forces between the different planets.
Yeah, and again, I think that's the thing where people just got to realize, like, we're still going to learn. We got to keep listening. We got to keep mm-hmm. learning because something else is coming. Mm-hmm. We're not done yet. The show's not over. We don't know everything. So keep listening, keep learning.
And on that beautiful note, on keep listening, keep learning, are there any other beautiful words that you'd like to impart to our listeners today?
Just a reminder to everybody that you are already enough.
Amazing. And how can folks find you and find the amazing Pack Theater?
The Pack Theater can be found online at packtheater.com. Awesome. And all our shows, me, all our teachers are there to be found.
Sweet. I want to thank Mr. Miles Stroth for giving us so much time today, for sharing so much insight, for being amazing. Thank you for the work that you're doing in the community. Thank you for, you know, teaching me so much, because I've now like doing your class remix, because I took it back in the early 2000s before I learned how to do any of the political stuff. But being able to know ahead of time to just listen and say yes and to anybody made it so I could walk into a political office and be like, all right, yeah, we can go ahead and make the world's largest phone bank. Yes, and let's do it. And a lot of that came from a lot of the learning that I got from the improv community. And a lot of it came from you, like specifically, like the deconstruction is one of the best things for anyone to ever learn. You guys don't know about that right now, but the deconstruction is a form that Miles, again, another Miles Stroth being a part of the beginnings, to look at how you start from a large thing and then break it down to its composite pieces. Once you learn that skill, you can apply it anywhere. And I learned that from you. And so thank you so much. It's been an honor, a privilege, and a pleasure to have this talk and to have you as a friend.
Pleasure has truly been mine.
Thank you so much for listening to the Vote Plan podcast. Please remember to hit the like and subscribe button so that you can keep getting fantastic Vote Plan content. You can find Vote Plan at on Twitter at Vote Plan 2020, on Instagram, and on Facebook at Vote Plan 2020. You can also find our website to download your own Vote Plan at voteplan.us. Thank you so much. Keep washing your hands. Keep staying socially distant. Be safe. Be happy. Find joy every day. This is Marquise signing out. Go vote November 3rd.